Welcome to the Wise Wealth podcast for everybody that's listening. We've got a really exciting guest on the podcast today. We've got Dr. Sumit. Very excited to get this conversation going. I think from an entrepreneurial side, from a company side, from a raising side, there's so many different points to touch on here, as well as what you're working on within those companies and sort of the research behind it. So if you can you give yourself a introduction to everybody listening so they just know a little bit more about you?
Well, thanks, Sam. Firstly, thanks for having me on and, really excited for this conversation. I guess just starting from my background, I'm a medical doctor by training, graduated from Oxford University, practiced as a doctor in the NHS for a very short period of time as a junior doctor, and then transitioned over to McKinsey, which is a management consulting firm. At McKinsey, I worked mostly in, healthcare projects and then in the end, in a lot of pharma and biotech projects. And that was actually where I had my first kind of schooling and I first recognized this opportunity, which I then took forward across multiple biotechs now, most recently in Zora Bio, which is listed on NASDAQ in the US. And that opportunity was that you've got a lot of big pharma companies and you'll be familiar with some of these names like Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Novartis. We actually have two in the UK in Glaxo and AstraZeneca. And they have, a multitude of programs in their pipeline. So they have a number of drugs that are already approved and they're selling. And they have a multitude of programs in their pipeline. And oftentimes they have more programs in the pipeline than that they can actually take forward into development. You may be familiar with what's now become quite a famous figure of it can cost over $1 billion to take one drug from research all the way through to approval and to the market. And you can't do that if you've got over 100 or some in some cases 500 drugs in the pipeline. So when I was at McKinsey, we were working on some very interesting projects where we were looking at ways to reposition pipelines for some big pharma companies. I then recognized an opportunity that, when big strategic decisions are made at these companies, some individual assets get left behind. And then I left McKinsey and set up my first biotech, where I took an asset which was already through kind of mid-stage clinical trials from a global pharma company, originally a Japanese company, a company called Takeda. And I took the asset forward in a small UK private biotech through a number of clinical studies and ended up selling that company to a US biotech company called Roivant, who are now listed on NASDAQ. That was my first experience as a founder, setting up the company, taking it forward through operations and then actually selling it. And then most recently, and I'll sort of take a pause here, is I set up Zora Bio. That's a company that's listed on NASDAQ currently under the ticker Zora, Zura. And that's a similar program, but maybe slightly more ambitious. So we took three assets, one from Pfizer and two from Eli Lilly, both two large US pharma companies. And we're taking those assets through clinical trials at the moment. Have raised around $150 million and took the company public last year, which was a very tough time to go public. And as you're familiar with capital markets, last year was a pretty tough time. So we've had an interesting journey. And that's kind of my personal story and also the story of the company.
So I suppose really that's a fantastic journey. I think I didn't even know that was a thing. So can you actually take research from these other pharma companies and carry it forward yourself?
Yeah, so it's not something that's been done kind of to a great extent. What's probably more common, this is a slight variation on that. What's more common is kind of repurposing of medicine. So probably the most famous example is Viagra. So this was a drug that was used initially, it was developed for heart kind of conditions and different cardiovascular type conditions. And then famously, one of the kind of side effects of the drug in the initial trials was, what we now use it for. And some researchers, at Pfizer at the time kind of established this side effect profile is actually something that could be quite useful. And then the drug was repurposed into the current use. So that's one of the most famous examples. So what often happens in some of these cases is you've got a drug that's being developed for one thing, but some biology emerges somewhere else. And that may be off strategy, for these companies. So one of the examples in the case of one of the drugs that we took over from Eli Lilly was that, the biology sort of emerged first in the skin, which is where Lilly took it forward. Didn't really show much there, but then there was a load of new clinical studies done by other companies with the same mechanism in the lung. Lilly in this particular instance didn't have a respiratory franchise, so that this drug then becomes available for a partner to come out and advance it. And that's for the benefit of both the originator, so the big pharma company in this case, and the partner, because they continue to carry equity and some economic forward in the program. So it's not like it's, hey, you know, take this and they wash their hands. It's kind of a collaboration of sorts.
So I suppose that's an interesting one, because that's what I was trying to get to, is when you've got like the initial research was done by the big companies, you come in and say, we want to take it over and repurpose it. How does that conversation even go? Are you reaching out to them saying, we want to take this drug, we want to look at testing it in different areas? How does that even conversation happen, of where they go, and yeah, we'd like to keep X equity with your research going forward?
Yeah, so it's actually a very interesting and innovative ecosystem in the biotech big pharma landscape. So a lot of discussions actually happen the other way, which is a small biotech is working on something innovative. It happens to be in an area that, you know, another bigger company is interested in, maybe scientifically or maybe commercially if it's slightly later stage in terms of its development. And then, you know, there's that bilateral discussion. Now, that's kind of, I would say, more common in the way the discussions go in that direction. The other direction is probably, you know, to your point, is a little bit more nuanced, more interesting. It's usually, you know, in my case anyway, a team of kind of entrepreneurial founders, myself, you know, are interested in a particular mechanism. So say, for example, you're interested in, you know, just to take a random example, something that you're excited about in chronic cough space. So you think, hey, there's this particular area of biology I'm really excited about. And you know, how do I now go about creating a drug? So you can start from scratch. So you could say, hey, let's go to the labs, let's, you know, synthesize a compound or create a biologic drug. And that will take you, you know, probably 3 to 4 years to get into the clinic. Or you could say, hey, okay, I'm interested in this biology. I wonder if anyone else is also interested in this area. And then, oh, there are 3 or 4 people that are, you know, some of whom are probably still interested in the area, in which case it's very difficult to have that negotiation. And maybe, you know, in these instances, there's someone who's kind of deprioritized for whatever reason their efforts. And that gives you, as the person who's got, you know, the interest, a head start, you know, or a leg up as to where your starting point would be versus starting from scratch. You know, so that's kind of the theory. It doesn't always work out in practice, because as you can imagine, these are like, you know, there's been whole teams working on these assets. So it's very hard to take over someone else's baby almost. So you have to have a very safe pair of hands, you know, on the receiving side, you know, demonstrate your ability to raise capital, your ability to actually progress these programs with an expert team, which is what we have and what we've built.
So I suppose that's where you are now. How did you get to that situation though, I suppose, on your first exit? Because obviously if you're new to it, you came out of, you know, being a doctor and then going straight into this to then selling that company. How did that come about, and why were they interested in you at that early stage without having that track record?
So it's always a bit more romantic, you know, telling the story going backwards. I think when you're going forwards, it's not always immediately clear. A lot of this is, you know, serendipity and things, you know, you meet certain people and things happen at the right time. And I think, you know, my first company is probably a good example of that. So, you know, I would say at McKinsey, I got this high level view that, you know, big pharma companies make very big decisions and then individual assets get sometimes left behind, right? That's a thesis that, you know, in principle sounds exciting, but in practice, you then have to find an asset that you're excited about. The way that came about in my first company and what we've done going forward since then is we come up first with a biological thesis or a biological rationale. So that would mean, hey, this is the particular area of biology I'm interested in, or more specifically than that, this is the drug target that I'm interested in. So in my first company, which was a small private UK biotech, it was called Izana Bioscience. I was interested in a particular immunological pathway called the GM-CSF pathway. Now, this is a pathway that many pharma companies have actually tried to target. And then this is where the kind of serendipity comes into play. You know, there was a company, in this case, Takeda, who'd taken an asset forward, you know, and spent actually hundreds of millions of dollars on this asset. And we were able to license that program because they were no longer progressing it. So that was kind of the two things coming together. Hey, I'm interested in this biology. Here's an actual drug that's been developed against this target. And that was my first company. And, you know, I teamed up with a great co-founder and chairman in that case, who's a multiple kind of serial entrepreneur, who has to some extent done this kind of thing before, you know, in a slightly different context. So, you know, that was a useful partnership, again, that we had between us. And then, you know, similarly in Zora Bio, we've probably taken that, you know, as I said, in a slightly more ambitious fashion with 3 programs, raised much more capital have gone public in the US. And our chairman of the company is a guy called Amit Munshi, who's previously CEO of a company called Arena Pharma, which sold to Pfizer for $6.7 billion. So he's, again, got a lot of experience of, you know, how to build these companies at scale and progress these kinds of assets in this space of immunology that we're interested in. So I would say it's a combination of being, you know, having a smart idea, but yeah, much more than that, it's, you know, meeting the right people, the right timing, having the right discussions. And these discussions do take a very long time. So it's not like, you know, you can have the idea today and you stand up the company tomorrow. If you're doing licensing deals and working with big companies, there's a long process usually to go through.
And I suppose just out of interest, that company that you did then sell on, where is that drug now? And have they implemented that into the market?
Yeah, so a good question. So we actually, this drug has a unique history. So it was trialed in rheumatoid arthritis, which is probably a condition that you've heard of and are familiar with. It's, you know, arthritis, which usually affects the small joints. It actually worked in that condition. And this is kind of, again, one of the intricacies of drug development. You don't just have to get the biology right. You also have to get the commercial side right. And I think what happened there is, you know, rheumatoid arthritis is a very established, now quite competitive field. So it worked in that indication, but, you know, wasn't quite right commercially for this company to take forward. We actually did a number of trials in that case in arthritis of the spine, which is a condition called ankylosing spondylitis. Again, it's not as common as rheumatoid, but it's becoming more and more recognized now. The drug sort of showed some ability to work there, but wasn't, you know, a great sort of standout result. And at the same time, when the COVID-19 pandemic happened, this area of biology became interesting from a treatment perspective there. So, you know, as you remember from the COVID programs, there were the vaccines, which prevent you getting COVID. And then there were a series of treatments which can treat patients as they get more severe if they already have the infection. This was in that treatment category. So we actually did a clinical trial supported by the UK government, led by the University of Birmingham, where we showed some efficacy in COVID-19. That led to the collaboration with Roivant, who had a similar program in their space here. And they took over our asset. And then, you know, as they've moved it forward, they've actually gone into a condition called sarcoidosis. So again, this is all kind of connected biology, but I would say that drug's, you know, still making its way through mid to late stage clinical trials. It hasn't quite got to the market yet, but we're sort of learning more about that pathway as we take it through a number of studies.
It's crazy how much money's floating around through each of those stages as well, because I'm assuming they have to like acquire, if you sold the company, they would have to have bought your asset, I'm assuming, or bought the company to then progress it into their own sort of like agenda, I suppose, or a different approach that they're taking. Is that right to say?
Yeah. So with any kind of asset deal or licensing deal, there's two large costs. One is the upfront cost of actually acquiring the asset, as you rightly said. And the second cost, which can sometimes be more than the actual acquisition, is the actual investment into the next phase of clinical studies. So I would say there's kind of those two big buckets. You know, we can be creative on deal structures and, you know, you can come up with ways of having success-based milestones and, you know, paying as you develop the compound and take it forward. You know, taking equity can always sometimes be quite lucrative as well. So, you know, there are ways to be creative to kind of balance that cost. But I think, you know, a good partnership always works where there's a recognition from each side that, hey, you know, taking this drug from point A to point B is actually going to cost, you know, usually in the order of tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, we have to be kind of collaborative in the way in which we construct these deals. And so far, I think we have taken the approach where, whether we're buying or selling, that we try and take a kind of collaborative approach. You know, it takes a lot of people and a lot of effort, as well as a lot of dollars to get these drugs through to help patients eventually, which is our aim.
Yeah. I think that's fascinating. I suppose with the company that you're now involved, you've got three different assets. What do those focus on? What's the difference in those?
Yeah, so generally, kind of the area of interest that I've pursued is immunology, so autoimmune diseases. This is where the body's immune system works in a way where it ends up actually attacking itself. So it attacks different organs or cells in the body. And so most of the ways in which we try and tackle that currently is we try and attenuate, so dampen down the immune system. Now, what we're sort of realizing here is that, you know, you can do that in a multitude of ways. Traditionally, it's been done by taking out a single pathway. So if you think of the immune system, you know, almost as the London Underground, there's lots of lines, and you can kind of take out one signaling pathway, and that will kind of tell the body's immune system to kind of dampen down. What we're doing in Zora is, you know, I would say slightly more innovative than that, is we're actually taking a approach where we can dampen down more than one pathway with the same molecule. So these molecules, especially our lead compound, which is called tibulizumab, which is a bit of a mouthful, is actually a bispecific. So it's kind of like two molecules joined together into a single compound, and it inhibits two validated pathways in biology. So we think that's going to actually move the needle for patients going forward. So we're really excited about that. And that's kind of the compound that we licensed in just after we went public last year. So that's kind of our overall thesis. Obviously, happy to go into detail on kind of the various
etc. Well, no, I think that's very interesting. I suppose as when you're talking about it listed on the markets, I suppose the valuation of the company can excel rather quickly if, for example, another company like Pfizer or anyone else then basically says, we would like to come in on this with you, because there's extra backing in it. The valuation is there. You have a bigger company working with you. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So I guess there are two ways to think about it. One is your internal data-driven kind of value creation. So that is where, hey, we've got this compound, we've taken it into the clinic, we did a clinical study in, say, 100 patients. This is just a hypothetical example. And, you know, we've shown this data, and this data has now pushed the probability of success for this compound significantly higher, because we've established it has the ability to work in this patient group, or we've established it's safe, or, you know, whatever risk you've discharged. That's a way then to demonstrate significant value that, you know, you've done internally. The second kind of one of the other ways, which is kind of what you said, is the externally driven value creation events. And now they can come in a multitude of forms. It could be a partner or someone coming in saying, hey, what you guys are doing is interesting in the example that you gave. And then, you know, we're now going to imply this level of value upon you. Or it could be that there's another player in the space, could be a biotech, could be a big pharma company, also working in the same or a similar pathway. And they demonstrate that, hey, you know, this drug or this pathway is able to do this. And then the natural kind of implication would be, well, hey, if company A is able to do this with something, you know, the same or similar, well, why would company B not be able to show the same? And therefore you get kind of an appreciation in that regard as well. So I would say, you know, internal and external is the way to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it? Because from a valuation perspective, there's a lot of different variables outside of what I would class as like a traditional company that can actually change the valuation behind that business quite quickly. And so let's go through the story of how and why did you decide to list the company, and what was the process sort of behind that?
Yeah, so we took a unique path to public markets. It was originally a SPAC called Jet Acquisition Corp, which I'd created. And SPACs were very popular in sort of, you know, immediate post-COVID timeframe. We took a slightly different approach in our SPAC, where we were actually a team of biotech founders and entrepreneurs. So most SPACs that you saw were kind of teams of finance people and investors. We were actually a team of company founders and company builders. I was the founder, chairman, CEO of the SPAC. One of my board members was the founder of a company called Moonlake, which actually went public via a de-SPAC and is also in the immunology space. So it was a very kind of specific skill set that we had gathered. And then we were out looking for, you know, interesting companies that fit the model of what we as a founding group particularly appreciated, which was taking, you know, underappreciated assets from pharma pipelines and then developing them going forward, which is Moonlake's also an example of that. And so we then worked very collaboratively with Zora Bio, to the extent that, you know, I actually crossed over then from CEO of the SPAC to CEO of the company, and continued now as a CEO. And we were kind of very supportive of this approach of bringing together these compounds. And actually, we bought in our lead asset after we went public. So we raised initially $65 million in the de-SPAC, which was the business combination. So that's when the SPAC and the target company merged. And then we bought in the lead asset from Lilly and raise an additional 80 million at that point alongside that asset. So it was kind of a twofold capital raising program, which happened within a very short space of time. So we went public in sort of March timeframe, bought this asset in May. So last year was a very busy year on capital markets for us. And as I said, it was a pretty tough year all around for capital markets. So it was a very interesting journey.
So I suppose the one thing there is, what made you go and start JAT Acquisition Corp initially? And was you the sole owner of that SPAC? And what made you just say, I want to go get a SPAC and, you know, take that as a route? Because obviously it's a great route for funding and it paid off very well. But what made you decide to, you know, start that?
Yeah, good question. I think in part it was my own experience of the previous biotech, which was a small UK company that hadn't really raised kind of the type of capital that it would have been, you know, probably would have been useful in that kind of context of developing a drug in the clinic, right? You needed a lot of capital to move those kind of things forward. So, you know, I achieved a lot with, you know, fairly, in hindsight, a fairly small amount of initial capital. And so I think one of the areas I wanted to address was the ability to raise capital, the ability to access capital markets in the US, which has traditionally been very tough for, you know, UK companies. And, you know, that's a topic that I think has been highlighted recently in terms of attractiveness of different capital markets. I think NASDAQ is clearly the one for biotech companies, because you have the investors with, you know, knowledge of the space around the table. So it was kind of, you know, how do we address two things? One is the ability to raise capital, which, you know, a SPAC is potentially a good vehicle for. We had dedicated capital alongside our SPAC. So it wasn't just the kind of capital that's parked in there that can then leave. So we were pretty sticky money. And then the second point is, you know, how do we make sure we're taking biotechs to the place where we think they ultimately need to be, which is NASDAQ? So I would say those two things came together in one vehicle, which was the SPAC vehicle at the time. We, as you say, are an example of a successful de-SPAC. Many SPACs actually didn't make it that far. And I think that's probably because of the approach we took, right? As I said, we're a team of founders, a team of biotech entrepreneurs. And that's what we really wanted to do. We wanted to help see through a great biotech into public markets. And I think testament to that is, if, you know, a few of us from the SPAC are actually still involved. So I'm CEO. One of our board members, the guy I mentioned earlier, has also become a board member now of Zora, because we're very hands-on. We're very dedicated to kind of seeing this through as a success story. So that's a bit different from other SPACs that were out there, just, you know, do a deal and move on.
Yeah. Now, I suppose from my perspective, though, like obviously you being a doctor, where did you go, right, I'm going to go and buy, you know, I'm going to go out and get a SPAC today. Like, you know, how did that come about? Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, because, you know, the doctor side of me and, you know, what I learned at McKinsey was very focused on more what we've discussed at the first half of the conversation, which is around the assets, the biology. Are these commercially viable or not? How do you develop these things? So that's what naturally, I guess, flows into my background. I guess I did a lot of learning on, you know, financial structuring, capital markets, but it was probably driven by the opportunity, right? I think I'd sort of successfully built and ran and exited a biotech previously. I wanted to take that into a more ambitious kind of project. And in order to do that, you need to be able to raise capital and access capital markets. And, oh, here's a structure that lets you do both, you know, almost at the same time. So, you know, in theory, this made total sense. But to your point, in practice, there's a lot of, you know, nuance and detail that you have to work through to get there. And that's where you need to build, you know, a strong team. And that's both your internal team, but also your team of advisors. And I think what we found in that kind of time period when SPACs, you know, were being very popular, is that a lot of people kind of came into that market. And what we see now, however, is, you know, only the high quality deals made it through to the other end. And now the market's kind of settled back down into the people that have been doing SPACs for a number of years. We've got to remember that this isn't a new vehicle. It's been around for decades, actually. It just got very popular, you know, recently.
Was it on the shelf? Like, was the SPAC on the shelf? Was it not being traded or utilized before you?
No, we launched. So from start to finish, from scratch, we launched the SPAC. And so, you know, it was an interesting journey. So we traded that, launched that, launched it on NYSE, so New York Stock Exchange. And then when we did the business combination, we flipped over to NASDAQ. So yeah, it was end to end, you know, from start to finish. It wasn't something that was already there that we picked up.
Yeah. I was going to say, how long was that process to do that?
It went public in 2021. So, you know, I would say it was probably about 6 months of planning to get it up and running. And then, you know, the key for us, I would say, you know, in hindsight, was building the right team, bringing the right people around the table. That's both in terms of management team and then the board members that help you kind of shepherd a deal through. I think we did that bit really well. And we kind of, as I said, had this focus on company building expertise. And then obviously the other key is being able to raise capital.
I think that's probably one of the big questions. You know, you mentioned earlier about raising 160 million. How did you find those people? Was that via public interest from it being listed on the NASDAQ? Or was a lot of that raising done privately through contacts?
No, I would say that, you know, in a biotech context, there are two types of investors. And you've seen both in the last 3 to 4 years that, you know, you've been looking at the markets, I would imagine. One is the very focused, dedicated biotech investor, and they generally would have, you know, fairly significant knowledge of the area of biology or the very technical knowledge around the type of program you're taking forward, whether it's a small molecule, like, you know, chemistry, or whether it's a biologic drug like an antibody or whatever. So they are very focused and specific type investors that, you know, do this day in, day out and look at companies like Zora and others. And then there are kind of more generalist investors. And, you know, when biotech had a very big rise after COVID, you saw the influx of generalist investors kind of coming in. And then, you know, when biotech, you know, had a tough time, which essentially was last year and for the last 18 months or so, you saw all those generalists kind of leave again. So I'd say there's two types of investors. They have kind of different ways of looking at companies. The biotech people are fundamental investors. They look at the biology, look at the technicalities around your asset, and assess kind of differentiation of your program versus other people's market fit, and make a very informed decision based on, you know, fundamental biology, fundamental commercial analysis. So the generalist investors also are very astute. You know, they have some of this knowledge available to them, but also would look at, you know, what the macro trends are in the space and which areas they'd like to allocate capital. So it's a slightly different conversation, but it's, yeah, I would say, you know, depends what you're bringing to the table and how well you're able to articulate that story that really determines, you know, the type of capital that you can raise.
So would you say majority of that then was done via the NASDAQ rather than sort of contacts that, you know, you didn't have people reaching out to you saying, I want to invest X, Y, and Z. I love what you're doing. We've been following your journey, know exactly what's going on. Or is it more through sort of like public announcements of what your plans are as a business, who the leadership team was, and then people investing via the NASDAQ that don't know you in person, don't know the leadership team or anything along those lines?
Yeah, I would say, again, it's a combination. So the latter, which is people investing via NASDAQ, tends to be, you know, smaller investors that, you know, are just interested in either you or the story or, you know, some member of the team or have heard about it from somewhere, right? And, oh, let's check out Zora. What are they doing? The more kind of fundamental biotech investors would actually come in, do, you know, more of a kind of due diligence, not just on what you're doing, but what others are doing in the space and kind of make that analysis. So I would say it's a combination of the two. What being on NASDAQ gives you is two things. One is access to both pools that you just, you know, articulated. And two is that you're a liquid position, right? So as opposed to investing into a private biotech company where if you put money in, you know, there's no way of then getting it back out. Obviously, when you're listed, you have the ability to, you know, have a more liquid position there. So I think there's, you know, a level of attractiveness. It does bring with it, however, a lot more kind of operational rigor, you know, the regulatory side of things as well. So it's a fairly, you know, large burden on a small company. And, you know, Zora was only established in 2022, and then went public in 2023. So it's a pretty, you know, young story.
And how many people are in the team at the moment?
The team is fairly small. So it's around 16 people. It's growing, you know, likely be 20 plus by the end of this year. We are, you know, extremely focused on a small number of clinical studies that we want to execute on. So we're pretty well placed right now with a small team. And then as you develop and go into additional studies and kind of build the company, obviously the team scales alongside that.
Will that funding that you've raised, 160 million, does it go far on a small team like that? Or is it something that's, you know, you're starting to sit there and go, right, within a year or so, we're going to have to look at doing another raise or trying to raise more money?
Yeah, so biotech, as we've established in this conversation, does take a fair amount of capital. The money that we've raised takes us through into 2026. So that's a reasonable runway. That means we can get trials up and running and then start to get data out the other end. So, you know, we're pretty comfortable now that, you know, we have enough of our own way to kind of establish the value that we've seen in these assets when we bought them in. And, you know, after that, we'll look to raise, you know, additional capital. So there's always kind of that tension between when do you have to, you know, raise capital again? And that exists for every biotech, whether you're private or public.
Yeah. So it's a hard journey because ultimately you're trying to get case studies over the line to get more value, but at the same time, trying to focus on the core aspect of what you're doing without having to worry too much about the raising. Trying to get that balance must be quite hard.
Yeah, it's a very astute observation, actually. So it's a difficult balance to get right. And I think the people that tread that line, you know, carefully are the ones who ultimately succeed. So, you know, one of the thoughts here is it's a very unique business model, as you've identified. It's an R&D business, right? So we're raising capital, putting it into clinical studies, doing research and development to try and get to the next inflection point of value. And that could be, you know, for some biotechs, that could be taking the drug all the way through, getting it onto the market and actually commercializing it. Or it could be, hey, we've shown it works in these patients, you know, and then, you know, another player comes in who's interested, you know. So there are different kind of ways to build out the ultimate commercial side. The focus for the company right now, as you said, is the research and development.
Yeah, because I suppose from your side, what it's probably more effective is to get some case studies under the belt, increase the valuation, onboard another partner, and then go back and then look at acquiring, taking an equity stake in their development, taking it forward, and then go back to look at other assets of which you could then acquire to do that. And ultimately, rather than going through with just that one and trying to take it all the way to completion, you then sort of like have that diversification over multiple assets of then increasing that return from more players basically coming on and keeping that equity stake in them. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways to think about it. I mean, as I said, you know, there's probably no right or wrong answer here. We as a company are very focused on our lead program and moving that through the clinic. And I think that will then open up various possibilities, you know, which could have even more connotations than what you've described. But, you know, right now, I think it's, you know, very head down focus on getting the clinical studies up and running to then take you to that next inflection point, which will then start to open up a multitude of decisions at that point.
And that is, where are those clinical sort of research at this moment in time? Where are you at?
Yeah, so we're going to get clinical studies up and running in the second half of this year. And there'll be global studies. So they'll include multiple countries, including countries in Europe, UK, US, and further afield. We're focused in a disease called systemic sclerosis or scleroderma, which is a rare disease that affects multiple organs, including the skin and the lungs. We have, you know, this is an area of huge unmet medical need. So we think we have validated biology with this molecule on both ends. As I said, it's a molecule where we've brought essentially two drugs together. So we're pretty excited about what we can demonstrate here. So we'll be getting that up and running in the second half of this year.
That's insane. And logistically, how on earth do you even get that across to be sort of like global? How do you integrate that to have those individuals ready for that study?
Yes, it's a good question. And actually, a lot of small companies generally work with CRO organizations or contract research organizations who have already a global infrastructure, and then you sort of plug into that for your specific study. Some of the larger companies, you know, build that in-house. We'll look to do somewhat of a hybrid where we have a lot of internal controls and then work with a global organization. Because it's a rare disease, you know, these patients, you know, not that common, although this is actually amongst the larger end of the rare disease spectrum. So yeah, we're going to have to work with expert sites, so hospitals and physicians who are used to seeing these types of patients, sometimes have built databases of these patients. And so there's a lot of kind of nuances in how you do rare disease drug development that we'll take forward.
So I suppose, is that like, you know, when you're at hospital and they come to you and approach you and say, we have got an alternative treatment that's in the early stages, is that what they're then signing up to, sort of thing from there? That's where the offer comes in?
Yeah, so that's one way to think about it, actually. So if you think about, you're a patient with a particular disease, you're probably seeing a doctor or a physician, you know, fairly regularly, or you may be a patient who's newly diagnosed. And if that physician is part of a clinical study that is up and running at the time, they can then have that discussion with the patient.
It's fascinating, really. It's a whole different side to than I've ever seen, really. So it's fantastic.
Well, I think for me, and you know, perhaps for your listeners, it's what's been unique about it for me is it's a fantastic blend of kind of science, the medical side, you know, of which drugs do you actually go after and which diseases, and then what we've just talked about, how do you operationalize that, combined with the financial side of, okay, we now need to raise this type of capital, use these type of structures to make this all come together. So it's been that unique blend that has been exciting and interesting. And what's, you know, as a medical doctor, what's ultimately unique is we're doing all of this, you know, large amount of effort to try and get drugs to patients who are, you know, in an indication of disease like systemic sclerosis are in desperate need. You know, there's nothing on the market that works for this condition overall. So, you know, it's all in that focus that we do this multitude of, you know, almost disparate things that we have to bring together, right? It's not immediately natural for a, you know, hardcore drug developer to understand capital markets and financing, but you have to kind of bring that all together to make it work.
Yeah. Well, so it's a testament to you as an entrepreneur, really, to go from, you know, the starting blocks, really, to take it to where you are now.
Yeah, I think one thing over my journey is this will be now the biotech that I've kind of had a hand in founding. I think I do particularly enjoy the founding period of, you know, the starting blocks, as you termed it. And that's a different period to, you know, what happens later on, which is when you're bringing more order to the origination, which can be a slightly more chaotic process.
Is there anything, any sort of finishing notes you would like to leave the audience with?
I guess just reflecting on, you know, the last few years, what's been interesting and unique for me is the ability, as I said, to build something based on disparate skill sets. And I think my natural kind of focus has always been on the drug development side, but being able to learn a new area, in this case, it was, you know, capital markets and the finance side, has actually enabled me to power up and be more ambitious in the thing that I'm excited about, which is getting drugs to patients in need. And so I think that's kind of been a unique insight is, you know, if you can learn something that you can add on to what you already are passionate and know about, it may help you kind of power up and have more ambition around what it is that you're doing. So just, yeah, reflecting on the last few years, probably that's been my kind of big note of unique, you know, and what may be interesting to your listeners here.
Yeah. And for anybody that's listening that wants to sort of follow your journey, follow the journey of the company, where's the best place for these individuals to go?
Well, the company's listed on NASDAQ. So the ticker is ZURA. So you can obviously follow the journey on NASDAQ. The company has a LinkedIn page, which is pretty active. And so they, you know, regularly post updates on there. So probably following Zura Bio on LinkedIn is a good way to do it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Good talking, Sam. Cheers.